It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you. You were mentioning earlier off the air that you didn't like bubbly people, so I'm going to try and reform myself.
Oh, I just said I have trouble adjusting to that speed at this hour of the morning.
Yeah, well, yeah, I do too. Okay.
All right.
Enough of that.
We're going to start with the national this week instead of local, since there's so much stuff happening nationally. So
yeah, and you know, a lot of it doesn't lend itself to bubbly and cheerful, actually.
No. Starting out with, it looks like people need to start marking their calendars for Karl Rove's.
Interesting report that came out last night by Jason Leopold in Truthout, and I've quoted him on this program before. He's generally been right on the money and about a week ahead of mainstream media in terms of development in the Valerie Plame case and Patrick Fitzgerald's probe. He is reporting that Rove met with President Bush and with Bush's chief of staff, Joshua Bolten, this week, told them that he is going to be indicted, both on perjury and possibly also on obstruction of justice charges, and that when that happens, he will resign his post in the administration. If this is true, and certainly all indications the last few weeks have been leading that way, it's a tremendous blow to Republicans, because, of course, Rove recently took over, rather he stepped back from his policy job in the White House to focus on helping the Republicans save their bacon in the November elections. And, of course, that job gets more difficult every week with the various scandals that roll out, of which we had another doozy this week. We'll get to that in a second. But Rove is by far the best strategist the Republicans have. And if he is on the sidelines and not available to them, or certainly not available to Bush and to the Republican National Committee because he's under indictment and has to focus on his own case the way that Scooter Libby has, it's going to make their job even that much more difficult. Now, I'm sure that he's sketched out a game plan between now and November, but, you know, a lot can happen between now and November, and having a field general that can, you know, make changes and adjustments as they go is pretty important for a plan like that. And let's face it, the Republicans have not been noted recently for their strategic genius when it comes to image making and political acumen. So this is a really important development on a couple of fronts, both the Plame case itself and Bush's credibility himself, of course, because if Rove was involved, as he certainly appears that he was, Bush has had to know about it for some time. Rove answers to Bush in a way that Scooter Libby did not, and you know, Bush has been hiding this fact from the public for some time. But above and beyond all that, it's a tremendous strategic blow for the Republicans. So you know, it's a good, nice trifecta.
All right. Well, I can't imagine how it came as that great a surprise to the media and people in power, but looks like the NSA was reaching out and touching a lot more people than had previously been noted.
Yeah, about 200 million customers of AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South. Anybody with a Verizon wireless cellular phone contract ought to be reconsidering that right about now. Quest, to its credit, and this will be the first time we've said anything nice about this on this program about Quest in the last 5 years. It was reported, at least in the USA Today article that came out on Thursday, as refusing to cooperate with the government's request that it hand over all of its phone records for data mining purposes by the NSA. Again, this was something that was hinted at and if not outright reported back in December. The Boston Globe had a story saying the NSA was not just monitoring international telephone calls to and from suspected al-Qaeda terrorists, but that it was using data mining operation to monitor the phone calls of many, many Americans on domestic calls. The LA Times had various articles that was pointing toward this sort of thing. The New York Times picked up off the Boston Globe article. I mean, this has been bubbling. There was even a lawsuit in San Francisco in January alleging this sort of thing. So this has been bubbling bubbling underneath the surface for months now. And why mainstream media has not picked the ball up and run with it sooner is anybody's guess. But that's the major reason why this report is being treated as so credible. You know, even though it's just from one news source from USA Today, and it doesn't actually quote any named sources, but it's being treated as credible because for people who've been following this, who are in the know, in the loop, it comes as no surprise. And again, for anybody in this country who thinks you have privacy in this country, you simply don't. The Fourth Amendment effectively no longer applies. It actually hasn't probably applied for the last 20 years, but it certainly hasn't applied after the Bush administration came into office, and it especially certainly hasn't applied after 9/11. So, you know, be advised. The question at this point has to do with the confirmation of General William Hayden, the former head of the NSA. His Senate confirmation hearings for him to take over the CIA from Porter Goss. Goss, of course, going down in flames around Hookergate and poker games at the Watergate, which also came out this week, as did the resignation of his number three man, a political crony named Dusty Fago. I don't know how you could make up a name like that. And incidentally, Fago's home and office were searched by the Department of Justice yesterday, so he's in trouble on possible corruption charges and other things. But Hayden is coming up for confirmation this week, and the one good thing that may come out of the this latest revelation in terms of the NSA has to do with the additional pressure it will put on Hayden's confirmation. Both from Democrats and Republicans are making noises about wanting to look at this more closely, and he'll have to testify under oath. Now, he has been asked in the past, not under oath, about whether political opponents of the White House have been targeted for spying, and he has refused to answer that question. It'll be very interesting to see if that question is posed under oath, and if so, what his response is. Probably very evasive. But one of the more disappointing things this past week was the reaction by Democrats to Hayden's nomination on Monday before this latest NSA spying scandal broke. You know, some Democrats were certainly concerned, but a number of them were not. Quite a few, like Dianne Feinstein, supported his nomination. It's the sort of thing where people keep waiting for the Democrats to act like a real opposition party. They've been making noise about the NSA warrantless domestic spying scandal since December, but then they wouldn't support Feingold's censure resolution, and now they were not in large number opposing Hayden's confirmation. But this is in many ways a politically explosive story, and it shouldn't be, both because people shouldn't be surprised and because if you count the different crimes of the Bush administration, I would count, you know, somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 dead from an illegally launched war based upon lies in Iraq, probably to be at the top of the list. And there's probably five or six other major crimes that are a lot more alarming than listening to people's phone calls. But this is something that affects people perceive it to affect their daily lives very directly, and they feel invaded by it. So it's political dynamite in a way that, you know, the deaths of some brown people on the other side of the world do not. And so it's going to be very interesting to see what the media shelf life is on this, whether Democrats and Republicans, for that matter, pick up on the popular mood or the popular reaction to it, and just how low President Bush's approval ratings can go, because he's already down at 30%. This can do nothing but hurt him more.
Well, perhaps the Justice Department was raiding the House and office of Third in Command at CIA because they couldn't get any more movement with the NSA. from the requests.
Yeah, that was another discouraging development this week, that the Justice Department announced that it was dropping its investigation into the warrantless domestic spying scandal at the NSA because the NSA wouldn't grant the Justice Department investigators security clearances to get the information they need to actually investigate the program. This, once again, is the White House, and in this case, an agency under the direct control of the White House, asserting itself to be above the law. It's something that we're hearing again and again. And, you know, none of this is going to change unless you get, Senate and House investigative committees, investigations from committees that have the power of subpoena that can force people under penalty of contempt of Congress to come in and testify under oath. And that's almost certainly something that's not going to happen concerning the Bush White House in any kind of serious way unless the Democrats can take back one or the other House in November. Whatever else you can or can't say about the mettle of the Democrats, that's one very important reason for trying to help them get control of the of Congress in November, or at least one house of Congress. It's not that they're going to institute sweeping reforms. It's not even that they particularly deserve the power. It's that there has to be some sort of accountability for the Bush administration for the crime that's committed against the Constitution and against the people of this country and the world. And that's not going to happen as long as the Republicans control Congress.
Well, speaking of above the law in a figurative and, in this case, a literal sense, there was an article this week about the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency.
Yeah, this is another not very widely noticed development this week involving an agency that virtually nobody has ever heard of. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency is the agency that controls the spy satellites and what they see. In other words, where it aims the camera, what it sees on the ground, and you know, compositing the different images, and they have a resolution capacity down to probably a few centimeters. They claim a meter, but I'll bet it's better than that. They had some publicity last fall for the pictures they were providing to people stricken by Katrina on the Gulf Coast, but basically they keep a very low profile. Well, the head of the NGIA, another military guy. Lieutenant General James Clapper said in an interview this week that the NGIA has been doing a lot more domestic surveillance in recent years than it ever has been before. In fact, the number of analysts that they have hired has gone up 40% in the last 5 years, and a lot of that has gone toward domestic surveillance. Well, the NGIA is like the NSA. It's not supposed to be doing domestic surveillance. There's other agencies that do satellite mapping the United States and things like that. Why again are we conducting warrantless surveillance operations on Americans or on facilities on American soil? So this is yet another front in which our privacy is being violated by the Bush administration. And I guess it's just become so common that media doesn't even particularly notice at this point.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad the Department of Homeland Security bringing everybody under one roof is working out the bugs.
Well, at least we're under a roof so they can't see what we're doing underneath the cover.
Oh, I guess they can.
Yeah, well, those are the cameras placed inside the walls.
Well, they have many ways of going right through walls. Give us an update on Mr. Abramoff.
Yes. No news this week involving Mr. Abramoff himself, but one of his former employees, a guy who also, before being hired by Mr. Abramoff, in fact, directly before Mr. Abramoff hired him, he was the chief of staff for Republican Congressman from Ohio Robert Nye, who has been under investigation for corruption for months now and is frequently mentioned as the congressperson most likely to be indicted first in the Abramoff scandal. Was former chief of staff, a guy named Neil Volz, who had time to be indicted for 4 years' worth of corruption from his time on Nye's staff and his time with Abramoff, and still only be 35 years of age. It really makes you wonder what qualifies guys like like these to have such positions of power at such a young age, other than knowing the right folks in college or, you know, having a well-connected daddy or something. But in any event, he pled guilty this week. He's the fourth major figure to plead guilty in the Abramoff scandal. He pled guilty to, quote, participating in a conspiracy to corrupt Robert Nye, his staff, and other members of Congress. Other members of Congress, so that implies that people other than Nye are also under investigation, with trips, free tickets, and meals. There was probably more than that, of course, but that's what the guilty plea included. He faces up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. They are laying the groundwork here to go after Nye and to go after other members of Congress. The more people that they can have entering guilty pleas and cooperate with the federal investigation and offering their own files and their own information, the stronger the case will be when they start going after the really big fish. And you can count on that happening this summer and in the period leading up to the November election. We're going to be still hearing quite a bit more about Mr. Abramoff.
All right. Also this week, speaking of big fish, there's some tax cuts for big fish.
Yes, but very little for the rest of us. The GOP in the House and the Senate reached agreement on a deal which would send $70 billion in Bush tax cuts through. It now has not – it passed the House immediately, has not passed the Senate yet, and there is a possibility that it won't pass the Senate. There have – in addition to solid Democratic opposition, there have been a few Republicans like Olympia Snowe who have said that they oppose the deal. So it's not clear it has the necessary votes, but it may well. What happened was that the larger package of Bush tax cuts got split into two. And what they did is they took the tax cuts that almost entirely benefit the rich, the wealthy, and they put them in one package. And they decided to pass that first because, of course, that's more politically important. The tax cut that's going through right now, for instance, extends the tax cuts on investment income, which promote how many lower income people get most of their income from in stock dividends and things like that. Part of the deal was that some of the other tax deductions, for example, that have expired that benefit primarily non-rich people, things like teachers being able to deduct the classes of supplies that they buy for their classroom, which most teachers have to do these days thanks to education budget cuts and No Child Left Behind, or deductibility of school tuition, things like that, that have already expired. Those were pushed off into a future tax cut package, and the reason they were is because the future tax cut package is less clear that it's going to be able to pass, and it's not because more people oppose it. It's because the taxes that are being cut or the tax cuts that are being extended in there cannot, through procedural rules in the Senate, be fast tracked. In other words, they can't do what they're trying to do with the $70 billion package that they're trying to ram through right now, which is to prohibit a filibuster and demand an up or down vote, so that instead of needing 50 votes to pass, the second tax cut package would probably need 60 votes to pass the Senate, because 40 Democrats or others filibustering could stop it. This means, of course, that the middle income or the middle class tax cuts that are being put in the future bill to sort of sweeten the pot, but they're also much more at risk of not happening, whereas the tax cuts for the rich that are in the current package are much more likely to happen. It really does tell you again where the Republican priorities are at, even though with record national deficits right now, you can pretty much gather where their priorities are at if this is a priority right now anyway.
All right. And then moving along to Little Fish, there's a Medicare deadline coming up on Monday?
Yes, there is. For signing up for the Part D prescription drug program, I had a column on this week at Working for Change, and people can read all the ugly details there. But it's a tremendously flawed program. I'm eligible, and I'm not signing up for it because I can't risk it. There's too many ways in which it can backfire for people who are signed up. There are a lot of activists that are trying to get the the May 15th deadline extended. That almost certainly will not happen before Monday. There is some movement even among Republicans to try and extend it in the future. However, President Bush has said that he will veto any legislation to fix any part of Part D, either extending the deadline or changing or abolishing the 1% per month. That is a minimum of 7% because you can't sign up for it again now that the registration deadline is passing until the end of the year. A 1% per month permanent lifetime surcharge if you don't sign up for it by Monday. There's a number of other problems with this plan, I say. Also, it's tremendously flawed. It's a huge piece of corporate welfare for the insurance and especially the drug industries. We're kind of short on time, but if you want to read all the ugly details, it was in Working for Change this week. It'll be in Seattle Weekly next week.
All right. You talked about last week, Divine Strike. There is a delay.
Yes, there is. There's a lawsuit, which is why there's a delay. The Winnemucca Indian Tribe and several other aggrieved parties that would be downwind from this test at the Nevada test site, which we talked about, is basically a dry run for a nuclear strike on Iran. They're trying to calibrate what size of a nuclear strike would affect the underground nuclear facilities in Iran. And so they're doing a simulated nuclear explosion that basically is the same kind of explosive that was used in the Oklahoma City bombing, only way more. It'll be a huge explosion. It has been delayed from June 2nd to at least June 23rd. How much longer than that it's delayed depends a lot on publicity and on how the lawsuit proceeds. And a lot of people still haven't heard about this, so spread the word. It's pretty outrageous.
All right. Can we jump over to international, or did you have anything else on national that you needed to cover?
Well, I would mention that Hillary Clinton and Rupert Murdoch are getting in bed together, but I can address that on the ETS blog.
All right. Well, you were talking about Iran, and there was a letter sent by the Iranian president.
Yes, President Ahmadinejad, I'll learn how to say that eventually, sent an 18-page letter to President Bush. It was the first official communication between the two governments since the 1978 Iranian Revolution. And what was remarkable about this letter wasn't so much the content. The president of Iran basically just reiterated a lot of his grievances and urged Bush, as somebody who claims to believe in Jesus, to live up to his religion's professed beliefs, which is something I've always wondered about. But what was more interesting was that this letter was widely reprinted in media outlets all over the world. Le Monde had a translation. The BBC ran it. It was run throughout the Middle East, etc. But aside from the Washington Post, I could find hardly any other media outlets in the United States that ran this letter. It begs the question, why? Why don't we find out what people who are designated as enemies of the state are saying and, are allowed to judge for ourselves whether they're rational or not?
All right. Also this week, it is becoming very evident that people in Palestine are under gross economic hardships.
Yeah, this is something that's been developing for weeks now because of the economic sanctions and effectively economic blockade that's being imposed by the United States and Israel especially, and to a lesser degree the European Union. But where it's hitting the hardest and the fastest is in medical facilities, especially on the Gaza Strip. You're starting to see people, especially folks on dialysis, diabetics, etc., die due to lack of medication, lack of supplies for dialysis, this sort of thing in the hospitals. And as with many other things that Israel does, and for that matter many other things that the U.S. does, it's just a gross violation of human rights and of international law that it's the sick and the weakest that are essentially being targeted and being made to pay for, in this case, what was a democratic choice and a fair election by the Palestinian people. And again, U.S. media is barely covering it at all.
All right. Well, speaking of elections, there are major protests continuing in Egypt this week.
Yes. Not elections. We mentioned that last week, where the emergency law was extended after the U.S. made all that noise in the last year about extending democracy to the Middle East and especially to Egypt. Well, we saw another example of Egyptian democracy and United States support for democracy at work yesterday, when demonstrators in Cairo were attacked by riot police while demonstrating in support of a couple of judges who are on trial for advocating an independent judiciary. Part of the problem with elections in Egypt is that the minister that oversees the judiciary, in other words, somebody who reports directly to Mubarak, oversees elections as well. And what the judges are advocating for is independent oversight of elections, which would sort of make sense if you want democracy. This is something that a lot of people in Egypt are really upset about, and the United States, true to George Bush's vision of a really leaning hard on its allies to become more democratic, said it was, quote, deeply concerned about the essentially police riot in Cairo yesterday.
All right. Unfortunately, very briefly, a couple developments in Africa.
Yeah, I'll blog about this at greater length, too, because it's truly outrageous. For anybody who read or saw the Constant Gardener, John le Carré's book and the movie based on it, it apparently is true to life. There's a Nigerian panel that came out this week with a report that Pfizer, the world's largest pharmaceutical company, was conducting unauthorized experiments on children suffering from meningitis in a backwater area of Nigeria in the mid-1990s. This for a drug that was later banned in the EU and severely restricted by the FDA for causing liver damage and leading to deaths. This is something that's really, really quite outrageous. Once again, the West bringing democracy and freedom to Africa. And also, we're on sub-Saharan Africa, a report by Save Our Children this week concerning Liberia that follows up on a report from 4 years ago that identified the same problem, and reforms were supposed to be put in place, but girls as young as 8 years old being used for sex and having sex demanded of them by food aid workers and UN peacekeepers, as well as school teachers and other education officials, in exchange for food aid, in exchange for fees that enable somebody to go to school, in exchange even for good grades. The problem is said to be widespread, with over 50% of girls being victimized in a lot of villages in Liberia.
All right. And quickly, events.
Yeah, I got a couple having to do with Mother's Day. Today, there will be a, quote, Mother's Day event for peace that will be held at the Army-Navy recruitment offices at 23rd and Jackson in the CD. And then tomorrow, as happens every Mother's Day, Ground Zero over in Kitsap County is going to be having its annual Mother's Day vigil and protest. There will be a vigil starting at noon at the main gate to the Bangor submarine base. And then for folks interested, there will be a nonviolence training at 3. And starting very early tomorrow morning, there will be a civil disobedience at that same gate. From a Monday morning.
Yeah. I'm sorry. And what was the time of the first event?
Noon tomorrow. Oh, I'm sorry. The first event, the one today, is also at noon.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Talking once again with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
The half hour goes by quicker every week. Eat the State comes out every couple weeks. It is a free paper of news and opinion about global as well as local events. Volunteers put it out. You can find it wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System. You can also find us on the web and our blog with things we didn't get to today, and activist calendar, all that other good stuff, www.eatthestate.org. And if you'd like to contribute or volunteer or have feedback of any kind, give our voicemail a ring. It's area code 206-719-6947.